Hello and welcome to Real Talk. I'm Susan McCabe, your host, here with you every Tuesday at noon and Friday at 6 p.m. to talk about whatever happens to be on our minds, answering questions large and small. Today, we're going to learn about something that's been in the news on people's minds globally, and that is, what is it like at the border of Mexico and the United States these days? And I have a gentleman here with me who has been there and has chronicled that experience in photographs. And they are now available to all of us in his book called Before the Border, A Work in Progress. Thank you for being with us, David Lynch.
Thank you for having me, Susan.
It's a pleasure. And I have to say, these photographs are gut-wrenching, informative. I learned a lot just looking at them. Now, my understanding is that you've been photographing folks in Central America for the last 25 years, starting with Guatemala. Is that correct?
Yeah, my first, what I would consider a professional breakaway and shooting seriously came in 1992 in Guatemala, where I stayed there for a year. And I just started to photograph. I was fascinated by the country and everything I was seeing around me. And it was still towards the waning years of a 35-year civil war. And I went down there on a visit, an invite from a friend. And I went down there not knowing much, and I ended up staying a year and began a document with my camera there.
That in itself is pretty amazing. Who can go away and go for a visit and end up staying for a year? That doesn't happen for most of us.
Yeah, that's right. Well, it's I've been kind of a vagabond with my camera, so it's hard to explain, but I think I was just listening to, you know, the internal self, and it was telling me to stay and start to document and start to become a photographer. And Guatemala was like the commencement of that. And then as time progressed, I found myself with the same internal systems tackling other projects along the years.
What was it about the people or the images in Guatemala that first captured you? Like, what was the first thing you saw in Guatemala that made you say, I need to document this?
Well, I think the best word I could use is mysterious. It was everything I didn't know in life. Up until that point, I hadn't really been traveled that much. And even though I traveled in the States and lived in other parts of the United States, it was very domesticated, so to say. And so when I went to Guatemala, it was completely unfamiliar to me. I didn't know any Spanish. I barely knew where the country was. And all the customs and everything. I mean, there was nothing that I knew, and I found it completely fascinating. The religious customs, the largely intact agrarian society, and how those systems operated, and the family systems. Everything was completely fresh and new to me, and I just loved it. And the people were the same. You know, they were just amazing, kind people, very welcoming.
And this sort of idea then carried through to other countries in Central America, as well as Haiti.
Yeah, that's right. Haiti came much later. That's fairly recent. That's within Haiti was 2015, I believe. And you know, it's not like I can actually finish any of these projects, but you know, one project evolves into the next, and you know, like everyone, I do have to, you know, work, and I find myself away from the camera for sometimes longer periods of time than I want it to be. In the last couple of years, I've really stepped it up, and I've devoted more time and energy into getting, you know, going to the next stage with, you know, the next evolved state with my work. And it's pretty much about, it sounds selfish, but I think a lot of people would agree, mostly artists or anyone doing serious work, it's just about immersion. And so I've just completely immersed in what I'm doing, and I haven't really looked back. And you know, the Migrant Project came about through, I think, a process of total immersion, and it kind of changed the course of my life. I was watching that story closely in the beginning, and being, you know, familiar with some of the systems that operate in Central America, and listening to the news, you know, my motivation to go down was mostly just to uncover the truth to the best way I could with my camera. And I didn't even actually know what that meant, but I knew I wasn't going to do anything just sitting here and thinking about it and looking at it on the news. So, you know, people often ask me, sometimes they look at my stuff and they say, well, how did you get that image? And I was like, well, I was there, you know, and it's not, I'm not trying to insult anybody, but it's just, you know, I just have to go. And to be a documentary photographer, you just have to be where it's going on.
That can't be easy. Now, when you say the Migrant Project, this is the project that's in the book, Before the Border.
That's right.
Migrants who are coming across America's southern border from Mexico.
That's right, yeah.
The caravans, as they have been known.
That's correct, yes.
How much time were you actually down there, and were you living as those people were living in the same conditions?
In the beginning, yes. I made one trip on a little zigzag course to find them. It's kind of a long story, but I just jumped on a plane one day and just went to Mexico City, and then I started asking where the caravans were and got directed to Oaxaca. You think it would be easy to find a large army of people moving through the countryside. It wasn't that easy, but I did find them eventually, and I spent my first week camped out in the fields with them as they were moving through the mountains. At that point, they weren't really walking too much. They were mostly getting picked up by trucks and, getting their slow caravan route to Mexico City taken care of by cattle trucks mostly. And my first couple nights, my first week actually, I was sleeping in the fields with the people. It was a very quiet, serene, very tranquil scene, believe it or not.
That's not how they've been characterized. There are certain people in our country who are characterizing them as criminals, and rapists.
Well, sure.
What kind of people did you find?
Okay, I'm not sure how political we're going to get here.
Just be honest.
Yeah, well, I will be honest. I think the book kind of says it. You know, these are just regular, everyday, mild-mannered, family-oriented people. And to be fair, there's photos in my book of gang members. I've talked to those people, and I hung out with them, and I've hung out with families, and the dad was an ex-gang member. And they don't really take – we could get into this for a very long period of time, but to keep it short, they don't choose gangs. The gangs choose them, and – it's a very difficult situation for them. I talked with several people. I met any number of people who are gang members, and they said, you know, we can't go back because they'll hurt us, they'll kill us if we go back. And strangely, about a week after I got back from my third trip down there, I was reading the paper, and all these gang members were killed going back to Honduras, which is where, you know.
Because they were deported?
Because they were deported, and then they had to go back to.
And they were killed.
And they were killed almost like right away.
Men and women.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's right.
That's stunning. Were most of these people coming from Honduras who were crossing the border, or were they coming from other countries as well?
Well, there was mostly, in my experience down there, I'd say it was 50-50 El Salvadorians and Hondurans, some Guatemalans, but 50-50, I'd say, on that ratio. There was a lot of people from both those countries. Yeah.
In this book, you have a wonderful introduction that is written both in Spanish and in English.
Yeah, that's right.
You say migration will continue to impact America's borders until the real causes are both known and addressed. Mm-hmm. What do you presume are those real causes?
Well, it's about, in my opinion, it's about taking responsibility. I think there's some very hardline history with developed countries that have their interests in other countries around the world. And it's these developed countries, I believe, that are at the root cause of what's going on right now. And no one's really looking at that. I think it's been addressed on some levels, but I think there's responsibility that needs to be taken. You know, there's a lot of economic despair, a lot of social injustice, and these are cause and effects of, I think, history.
Are you saying those developed countries are exploiting people in these less developed countries?
I could say that. Yeah, I could say that. And it's not just based on this particular project. I don't think I'm worldly enough to know the exact causes, but I've seen a lot of things down there that are certainly based on corporate gain. And
we're talking with David Lynch on Real Talk, if you're just tuning in, here on the Voice of Vashon at 101.9 FM, KVSH LP, Vashon Island, Washington. We can do this thanks to the generosity of Windermere Vashon Real Estate, who sponsor all our community information programming, and they make our emergency alert service possible. David is a documentary photographer who has just released a book of photographs with some description titled Before the Border, a work in progress from the Migration Project. David, you're going to be selling this book and showing some of the photos at Snapdragon soon. What is the date?
Oh, yeah, thanks for remembering that. That's in 2 weeks, a little less than 2 weeks. It's Thursday, March 23rd. At 6 o'clock at Snapdragon, I'm going to have Annie Burleigh, who is the book designer, the head book designer for Chatwin. She's going to just talk briefly. And Myrna Heck is also going to give a short little chat. And I might say something. I'm not sure. I'm just going to post some photos and you know, sell some books so I can kind of keep going with this project. That's the bottom line on that.
Just so our listeners know, this recording is being taped early. The opening and showing of David's photographs will be May 23rd at Snapdragon. Myrna Hecht is a poet and author who has worked a lot with migrants and will be making a presentation. And of course, Annie Burleigh is the designer and one of the publishers from Chatwin Books of Before the Border. You say it's a work in progress. What's next? What will you do next?
As far as the Migration Project goes, I have some ideas about where I want to do with that, and they're well known to me. You know, if I was to spill the beans, I guess I would say I'd like to go back and live in two sister cities, one on the Mexican side and one on the American side, and I want to broaden the scope of this project and document more in depth what's happening on both sides of the border. I'd like to, you know, document not only what's going on with the overcrowding of the facilities there because there's such a swelling of numbers coming in, but also like work with people who are doing activist work, even government agencies who are seeking to resolve this problem and make it smoother transition. There's all kinds of branches off of this larger tree, and I just want to keep giving a more comprehensive account of everyone who's involved with this.
Well, migration is a global problem.
Yes,
it is.
Yes.
And it is at crisis portions, at least at our southern border.
That's
between
right.
Mexico and uh-huh. the United States, and I'm going to guess in Turkey, Germany, England, I think they are all experiencing similar crises, though not
yes.
as voluminous, if you will, as the one at our southern border. What do you know about the scale of migration coming across the border? We're hearing that it is a crisis, that the numbers are increasing.
Yes.
Do you have any notion of to what we would attribute that? What's going on?
Well, I think there's a heightened swelling of people coming across at this particular time. I don't have any numbers in front of me, but there's certainly a lot of people, you know, coming across despite the current administration's efforts to keep back the numbers. So I don't really have a benchmark to compare this year's numbers with last year's numbers and what the press is actually saying between the two. But those numbers are seemingly increasing. And what's happened is I think the general infrastructures of some of these countries in Central America are failing to such a large degree that there is no work. In a lot of places, there's not a lot of safety. There's gang violence. There's a lot of drugs. And all those have heightened to a degree where they have impeded a quality of life in these countries that people can no longer tolerate. When I talked with some of the people, typically what they would say is, and I know this because their English was good, and my Spanish is so-so, so they were very clear what they were saying to me. I didn't need an interpreter. And they all just said the same thing in a very mild-mannered tone, and it was many things, but mostly it was that I can't go back. There's nothing to go back to. There's no work, and I fear for the safety of our children. And it's, you know, usually about the children. And yes, there was a lot of males. I'd say average age was 18 to 35 coming to America as part of this caravan just to seek work. But there was also a large amount of families coming too because they really feared for the safety of their family.
Did they talk with you about what they expected when they crossed the border? What did they expect to find in the United States? And were they surprised by the reception they got?
Yes. My understanding is a lot of them did not have a plan. Their plan was to simply go for the reasons I just stated. Mm-hmm. The situation is so bad where they came from that their only hope was to go to America. I mean, and it's often hard for people to put themselves in that situation when, you know, I mean, here we are living in the United States and everything's pretty rosy in most regards. You know, this is a first world country and so we just have a normal life here and every day goes by. But when you're actually living in a situation where your everyday living situation is awful and it's intolerable and there's no water and there's food and there's no work, so there's no money to get the things you need. And so, you know, your choices start to run out. And quite honestly, after talking to any number of these people, I would, if that was me and I was in that situation, I would do everything I could to get in the United States. I certainly would.
Can you be a little more, well, tell us, each one of these people is an individual. Is there an individual story or two that stuck with you that share with us?
I did an interview, which I wasn't planning on doing because I don't shoot video. But for some reason, I was with a family staying in one of the street camps in Tijuana after they had come up from Honduras. And his name was Alex. I'm not going to say his last name. And he was with a family of two children and his wife. They were probably in their early 30s. Their children were 4 and 6, and a little boy and a little girl. And they had come all the way up from Honduras. They had jumped La Bestia, which is a infamous train that comes up. He had an amazing story. I have it recorded. And it's much more powerful than any photo I took. Just the oral story is unbelievable. And he doesn't sensationalize. He's, you know, during the course of this 15-minute piece that I have, he's very monotone, very unemotional, very truthful, near as I can tell. I mean, you couldn't make this stuff up. And he was an ex-Honduras gang member. He's covered in tattoos from the gang, changed his life, told me about what it was like to be in a gang in Honduras, which we don't need to get into. There wasn't really much to say except, you know, that was just a factual statement. But his experience getting up to the States was remarkable. And heartbreaking. Just heartbreaking. Well, the conditions he had to endure with his children, being on a very dangerous train, that experience alone, I've known of the Labestia for years, and this is a train that runs up through Mexico, and people just basically hop on top of it because it's, you know, free transportation more or less, and it's a free ride, but it's a very dangerous ride. And
so he and his wife and his children were on top of the train.
They jumped on top of the train. And the reason why you don't go inside the train, like as in a boxcar, as he said, was that as dangerous as being on top was, hanging on to a fleeting, you know, piece of steel.
Yeah.
Cold, hungry, dehydrated, was because you could see who was getting on board. And when you're in the boxcar and it stops, you don't know who's getting on board, and that's when all the trouble starts. So that's why people are hanging on top of this train.
So there could be dangerous people getting on board.
That's right. They could see who they were. They could tell who's coming near them and being on board.
Is it possible he was being pursued by Honduran gangs that far away from Honduras?
No. He said there was no danger of that, but the danger was in fact in going back to Honduras. And he said he would be killed if he went back there.
Well, what kind of people were dangerous on the train?
Just locals, you know, just people who were robbing off the train.
I see.
At knife point and gun point, people who would, you know, pick off people who were on that train. And it's not elite to the caravans. This has been going on for years, except that it's gotten much more dangerous because the numbers have proliferated so much that there's many more people to rob from. So, you know, you have more robbers, there's more people, the business is good. And so they actually stopped Labestia at some point while I was there just because it was so dangerous that they weren't running it anymore.
They stopped running it altogether.
Well, they did temporarily. It could be running right now. I'm a little out of touch. I've been trying to find out some information, but it's probably back running, but they did halt it during the heightened movement of the caravans a couple months ago.
So let's get back to Alex and his family.
Uh-huh.
He had a wife, two kids.
That's right. What?
How many personal possessions were they able to bring with them on this journey?
Typically, even for a family like Alex, everything they owned would go into small plastic bags. Few had backpacks. The numbers that I saw, they were always with black plastic bags that they threw over their shoulder. Some people had backpacks. Sometimes little kids were carrying their own little backpack, but mostly it was, and families of course would have more. They had a black plastic bag in each hand. That's it. And, you know, some were heavy, some were not, but they carried very, very little things. And then as the caravan progressed up, through Mexico, churches and civic groups would provide them with sleeping bags and tents and so on and so forth. But everyone I talked to and everyone I saw had just, toiletry, personal items, a cell phone, and not much else. They carried very few possessions. Some were without shoes for days. There was no sleeping bags. They had nothing.
I see photos of men sleeping outdoors.
Uh-huh.
Were men and women and children separated at nighttime?
That came later. In the beginning, my understanding is no. When I saw them, they were all just all together. And then as the caravans got more organized and came closer to Tijuana, and they stayed at shelters in Tijuana, they separated the families from individuals. Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, but not always. It's hard to know. Sometimes they would cordon off a whole area that would just be like the moms and the kids.
When you say they, who are you talking about?
I'm sorry, I missed that question.
When you say they, they cordoned off, they organized.
Oh well, they had authority. You know, when they came into when they came into Tijuana, they came into what I would say would be the hands of city government and the throngs of other organizations that started to control the masses, and they would move them from area to area. In the beginning, they came to a park called Benito Juarez. And it held about maybe 3,500, 4,000. Don't hold me to that number, but something like that. And everyone was just jammed in there. And it was only a few. It wasn't very far from the wall. They could see the wall perfectly from Benito Juarez. So what I saw was that when I got there, that was closed off, and they had moved them on to a place called El Barrietal, which was an outdoor, indoor kind of compound. and it was a 15 kilometers away or so from the wall. And part of me thinks that was just a psychological move, because in Benito Juarez, you can see the United States, and it's sitting right there. And so that's why they were trying to get across, because they can see it. But I think they moved them away specifically. And it's just my dime store Freud on that. But I think it was a move to just to keep them down and away from the wall. And then they gave reasons for them moving away from Benito Juarez in regards to sanitary conditions being poor. But, of course, they didn't provide any sanitary conditions to begin with. So, you know, it's all depends on how you want to look at that.
What would you say is the attitude of authorities toward these migrants in terms, let's say on a scale of 1 to 10, 1 being animal, 10 being...
I can't answer that.
Equal human?
I can't answer that knowing anything. I really can't speak for them. So I have to, like, disregard that, if you don't mind.
That's okay.
Because I really don't know. I honestly don't know.
What? I'm looking at some of the photos in the book, and here's okay. One titled Truck Overload in Juan Rodriguez Clara.
Yeah.
Tired and anxious people wait their turn to board overcrowded trucks that would travel through the night over mountain passes headed for the coastal town of Guadalajara.
Yeah.
These people are stacked on top of one another.
Yeah, they are.
On a truck.
It's like a pyramid, yeah.
And it's just a flatbed truck.
Yeah, that's right. It's okay. They actually kicked them off that truck.
They did.
they were going to pull away, but they actually pulled away rather safely. The photo was dramatic, I feel, because it's at night, and so it looks like they're going to pull away, and they almost did. And then the driver finally got out and threw his hands over his head, and he in complete disgust, and he's like, "Cut it out, man!" He says, "I can't take you down the street like that." So they knocked off a few at the top, but they were pretty crowded, but not like that.
It's a mountain of humans.
Yeah, it was just insane. Yeah,
there are photos in here titled "Redemption."
Yes,
religious services going on.
Yes,
presumably at the border.
No, that was in
where
an
was
encampment
that?
I know exactly where that was because I was there. Give me a second. It was in Santa Clara, in Oaxaca. So it was a Sunday morning, and it was an evangelico service they were giving. And it was going on like right near me. I saw it happening.
It looks like there was a lot of passion.
A lot of passion
involved.
Yeah, probably more than normal actually, because of the conditions they were under.
What do you want people to take away from your book? What do you want them? What are you trying to tell us?
Dignity, respect. Same things that you and I want. That's all. It's not that hard. These are all just people like everyone. And I know it may sound, I don't know. You hear it all the time now. But these are people who were thrown into a situation and a circumstance that they had no choice. And we're all the same, you know. We all want the same things in life. You know, we just want love and tranquility and then comes, you know, the respect and dignity that goes with that. There's no mystery there.
David, thank you for exposing us to that mystery in your book, Before the Border, A Work in Progress from the Migration Project. It's documentary photographs from our own David Lynch, not the David Lynch, our David Lynch. And you can see it May 23rd at Snapdragon. Thank you so much for joining us here on Real Talk.
Thank you, Susan. I appreciate it.
Of course. We're out of time. Stay tuned. You never know what you're going to hear on The Voice of Vashon at 101.9 FM, KVSH LP, Vashon Island, Washington. This has been Real Talk. I'm Susan McCabe, your host. I'm grateful to our theme music composer, Luke McQuillan, and the late Jack Barbash playing the piano. Thanks for listening.